Good afternoon. So last time we talked about mostly about brunch prediction. So that was this idea that when we can't figure out what instruction to run next, one thing we could do is we could just idle, not fetching anything new until we figure it out. But another option we have is that we can just run something. And often we can have a pretty good guess as to what a good thing to run is. So for example, if we have a conditional jump, well, there's only two possibilities. We should choose one of them and just start it. But of course, there's the problem of like, how do we still get the right answer in the case where that guess was wrong? And our solution for that is that once we figure out that the guess is wrong, we undo all the instructions that were in progress, which is known as squashing, sort of undoing those misrun instructions, making sure they don't have any effects. And usually this is pretty simple because the instructions probably won't have gotten very far yet, so they wouldn't really have changed anything important anyways. And we talked about some strategies for how do we decide what to run next. And one strategy we had was this static strategy, and by static I meant that we just looked at the instruction and decided based on that. We didn't use any of the context about what actually happened when we ran it. And we just said, okay, if it's going to a forwards location, then let's guess that probably doesn't happen. And if it's going to a backwards location, to an instruction at a lower address, let's guess that it probably does happen. And this worked out pretty well because it turns out that loops obey these properties. Now, of course, there's other conditional jumps that don't. So we'll guess wrong for them, but we're still guessing, so we're still going to do better. But if we want to do better than that, what we can do is we can take it into account, well, you know, we're writing this code. We can look at what actually happened. So we have these dynamic predictors. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to have a table in our processor of sort of what historically happened, and we're going to look up in that table. And a simple way to do that is we'll look at the address of the branching instruction, the instruction that might go to multiple places. We'll have an entry in the table for that saying what happened last time, and we'll just predict the same thing will happen again. We mentioned that, well, if that's not good enough, we could have more information than just what happened last time, and we can make a more sophisticated prediction. We also mentioned, though, there's some things that like might seem really hard to deal with, like return, and we can make different predictors for that. So for return, we have this problem that, you know, the problem isn't to know does the return jump somewhere or not, which was our problem with conditional jumps. We didn't have to predict, we don't want to predict, you know, yes or no. Well, definitely goes somewhere. We want to predict, you know, what is that address and how can we even make a guess at that? And one simple strategy for that was to have sort of a little stack of the recent return addresses from call and just use one of those as our prediction for where the return goes. And this is a prediction, so it doesn't matter if we don't handle all the corner cases of what if I, you know, modify the return address on the stack, or what if I, you know, don't actually match up my calls and returns exactly right. Not a problem. We'll just make a wrong guess, and we'll fix it the same way we do for a wrong guess for our conditional jumps. We have a way of doing it. So questions about these branch prediction topics for last time? Yes. So the question is, if an instruction is squashed but it needs the value to be forwarded to it, on the homework to be right that the value is never forwarded, we don't care. Though I would hope that we're not going to check that. In a real processor, what would happen is it would depend on how far the instruction got before it was squashed, whether it got to the point where we did that forwarding or not. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
In the case that you're reading something,
so the question, in the case where we're reading something from memory, in what stage of the pipeline do we do that? So I'm assuming we're talking about the instruction reads a value from memory, not the machine code, because we always read the machine code in the fetch stage. So if we're reading values, that always happens in the memory stage in the pipeline design we talked about. So we could have alternate designs that do it at a different point in time, but once we've talked about so far, it happens in the memory stage, which was right before that write back stage. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, how is partial credit going to work on the pipeline homework? My intention is that we'll have rubric items which are like, you know, did you handle forwarding correctly when two things were in the pipeline? Did you handle it correctly when there wasn't a dependency? For sort of Boolean things like that, and that will be what the grade is based on. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we're going to talk a bit more about instruction-level parallelism later, but first I'm going to have an interlude to talk about a topic we probably should have squeezed in earlier, and that's about something we want to cover, which is about connecting processors to devices. So we talked a lot about how individual processors work, and we didn't really talk about how they're connected to each other. So like when we have multiple cores, how does that happen, and how they're connected to I/O devices? And a way I like thinking about this is that sort of modern computers are kind of like little networks. So we talked about networks between computers. Turns out internally, there's also kind of a network. And one simple design, not the current one, we'll talk about more recent designs, is that we can imagine we have this sort of central communication line that's commonly known by the name the bus or the system bus, that connects all our processor cores, connects our memory, and it's also going to connect our I/O devices. This is not the only way we could design things, but this is a common design that has been used in the past, where we'll have sort of all our cores and our memory and all our devices connected to this common bus. And for our memory and our devices, probably our memory and devices won't natively understand what the message is sent on this bus, so we'll have these controllers that translate between the sort of protocol for the bus and what the memories and the USB and so on actually need. And so in this model, for a core to talk to an I/O device, as far as what happens in the hardware, it's essentially the same process as it uses to talk to the memory. It's going to use the same kind of messages, like read and write things, except rather than going to the memory controller, they'll go to the device controller, and the device controller will decide how to handle that. And so instead of reading data for memory, we might read recent key presses, or instead of writing data to memory, we might modify what's being displayed on the screen. But the processor will use the same kind of process it did to write to memory as it will to modify something on the screen as far as what the core itself is doing. So questions about this model? There it is. Yes? Can we have multiple buses? Yes. So I've showed you kind of the simplest way we could build this, but we could have a design where we separate these onto separate buses, maybe because we're worried about, oh, I don't want whatever the USB controller is doing to interfere with the memory, and that is something that you might see done on some processors. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So question, wouldn't there be some kind of controller for the entire bus to make sure no more than two things are communicating so there's no interference? Yes, so there's going to be some kind of hardware that deals with letting everyone connected to the bus decide who goes when and so on. Or which might be a controller or some kind of agreement on how we send signals on the bus. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah, and I've drawn this bus as a single wire, but commonly it will be like a whole bunch of wires. So for example, as a very concrete example, if you look up the documentation for the 8386, a chip from the 80s, that used this kind of design, it tells you that the pins going out of it are mostly for this bus. And there's not just one wire, there's a whole bunch of wires. There's, you know, the bus has, you send an address and data, so there's 30 bits to send to the address and 32 bits to send the data, and that's represented as 30 plus 32 wires that are all connected to the processor and everything else on the bus. And along with some other sort of signals that, you know, are sent in parallel, just this big bundle of wires is sort of a common design for these buses. So as I said, this is kind of the simple way to organize things, and modern processors, you know, have decided that there's kind of some problems here. Like, you know, it's kind of not nice that these cores, you know, are kind of sharing this communication mechanism, can't really work in parallel. So we might have some other designs. So this is a picture from AMD for one of their recent designs. So they have the cores and their communication, sort of the way they've organized things is not as a bus, but each of these four cores here sort of have connections to each other and connections to sort of a common I/O interface and connections to a memory. And when you want to go to, when say you have code running over here that wants to access something over here, it's going to have to somehow send a signal to that other core, which has the memory controller for that. So often they'll have designs where rather than having everything connected together, they'll kind of subset things. But the same kind of principle applies, that when we want to communicate, we kind of have a little network, and that little network is where we contact other cores, memory, potentially, and I/O devices. But rather than being everything is sort of all together, like everyone on the same Wi-Fi, we'll have some more complicated way so we can have presumably higher efficiency. As another concrete example, this is a diagram from Intel of their chip design where all their cores here are connected to each other in this kind of grid, and we have all the I/O devices on one end of the grid, and they have some way of routing messages from one to the other, just kind of like we talked about routing things in a quote-unquote normal network. And also we have our, on this grid, we also have on either end are memory controllers connected to these cores. Okay, so questions about such different ways of connecting things? Okay, so we're not going to go into detail about that, but I'd like you to know that even though I'm going to be showing this kind of single communication line model, that's not what modern chips use, because yes, it has some problems when we have tons of cores. This doesn't really keep working well. So one thing that this model would suggest is that if, let's say, I want to load a file from disk into memory, what I've suggested should happen is our processor is going to have to send, it's going to have to read from our disk controller all the data that came from the disk, and then send it to the memory controller. That's the model I suggested right now, because I told you the processor talks to the device controllers just like it talks to memory, but that means if we want to copy from the device controller to memory, how are we going to do that? We're going to load things from the device controller, the disk in this case, then store them in memory. And that's going to involve running instructions, which need to load the data and then store it. And that seems awfully annoying, because it turns out that, well, there's a more direct connection from the disk controller to the memory. It would be nice if we can use that. And people making hardware realized this and said, yeah, we probably shouldn't use that. And so what they'll allow is this trick where rather than the OS and the core processor saying, reading the data from the disk controller and then copying it to the memory, they'll just tell the disk controller, hey, please place the data at this address. And the disk controller, it's connected to the memory just as well as the processor is. So it can just write that data directly to the memory rather than having the processor bother with it. And later on, the processor can read the data that was written to the memory. And this will allow us to a lot more efficiently transfer data because we aren't keeping the CPU busy with copying the data, because both the disk controller can do that. It's connected to the right things to just send that data to the memory. And this idea is known as DMA, or direct memory access. So our dice controllers send stuff directly to the memory, in a way where the OS is going to tell them how to do that, but the OS is not actually going to need to do the work of having a loop that read from the disk, write it to memory, read from the disk, write it to memory. The device controller can just do that itself. Some questions about this direct memory access idea? Yeah?
Does the disk controller consider the hard drives and
the SSD? So the disk controller consider the hard drive and the SSD? So the disk controller is what's going to be attached to the hard drives or the SSDs or similar devices. Does that answer your question? And for the memory controller, that's attached to the DRAM, yes. And I'm kind of drawing these as separate boxes, so I'm not indicating where these physically are. So for example, very commonly, the memory controller and the processor cores will be on the same physical socket, and the disk controller would be separate, but that's obviously not, you could have all the variations of that, where they're separate or not separate. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, if the cores are directly requesting sending stuff to the memory, why don't we have a direct route? So we could have a more direct route. So if we look at, for example, Intel's picture here, our disk controllers would most likely be connected to here or here or here, one of these sort of green or purple lines. And so they kind of do have a more direct route to the memory than many of the cores. So in those designs that don't use a bus, we kind of do that sort of thing. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and the question was shouldn't we have a more direct route to between the disk controller and memory? Other questions? Yeah. So the question, is the disk controller a specific core that's managing the logic? So the disk controller is some hardware that someone built. It's possible the way they built that is that there's actually a processor there, or it's possible it's some simpler logic, depending on sort of how complicated the things the disk controller needs to do are. And I think probably on a modern disk, probably there's some processor involved just because commands you would send are complicated. But if they weren't complicated, you wouldn't necessarily need a processor. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
What exactly is PCIe?
PCIe, so I guess a way of thinking about it is, about USB as another sort of way of connecting devices, and PCIe is one of those, but sort of focused on very high performance and for internal devices to a machine. Does that answer your question? So it's just kind of a generic way of connecting things, but it's targeted to sort of different kinds of applications than USB is. Other questions? And I guess maybe to illustrate the answer to the PCIe question. So kind of here, I've illustrated, we have a USB controller that talks to other devices, and we can actually have some controllers that we can kind of think of as translators. So we can have a controller for some kind of other bus that connects another bunch of other devices which have their own controllers and kind of just things go multiple steps. That's a common thing that will happen, especially because, you know, our devices might not understand the sort of internal way the processor cores communicate, so we might need a translator, basically. Other questions? Okay. So that's my interlude about sort of connecting processors to each other and devices. And we're going to go back to last topic, which is more about instruction level parallelism. So we talked about pipelining and branch prediction. We're talking about ways of running multiple instructions at once. But we still have this restriction that we were starting or finishing at most one at a time. And this meant that sort of if we had one slow instruction, you know, we actually had to wait for that instruction potentially. So one instruction can slow everything down. And this is something that's kind of inconvenient, and we can do better for both of these issues. The issue that we're starting only one thing at a time, finishing only one thing at a time, and that one instruction can slow everything down if it's slow. So one thing we can do is we can start multiple instructions per cycle. So we just make everything wider, basically. So we say, rather than fetching one instruction worth of stuff, let's fetch two. Rather than reading the registers for one instruction, let's read the registers for two of them. Rather than doing one addition, let's have two at math circuits and use both of them. And this idea is known as multiple issue. We're starting multiple instructions at once. And you know, this is something we can do. And we can use sort of essentially the same strategies we learned for pipelining to deal with what if these instructions depend on each other. So we can do forwarding. We can stall one of them if needed and so on. It's a lot more complicated to implement that logic, of course. But that's something we can do. So this is an idea called multiple issues. So just basically making our pipeline wider, handling multiple instructions, and assuming they're independent, we can actually run them at the same time. So in this example, you know, there's no reason we need to worry about what the add does for the subtract because they use completely different registers. If they didn't, then we would have to stall one of them and this would run slower. So questions about this multiple issue idea? So this is dealing with the issue of starting only one instruction per cycle. We can do better. So another thing we can do is dealing with one instruction slowing everything down. So let's say here I have this move instruction that takes a while. And the subtract instruction after it like needs its result. And in our pipeline processor, we just wait for that move instruction to finish before we let the subtract instruction finish, and we'd be stalling for many cycles here because the cache was slow. And here, by slow, I wrote have it as 3 cycles, but maybe like 10 or 20 might be more realistic if it's like really a cache miss in the L1 and L2. But what we can do is rather than just saying we're not going to do anything, is we could just keep running more instructions, as long as they don't depend on the result. So this add and this XOR here, they don't care about R8 and R9. We should be able to run them. So we do that. And this is known as out of order. So because we're running the instructions in a different order than they actually sort of appear in our assembly, then they logically run. And when we implement this, we're going to want to provide the illusion that the work is still done in order, in the sense that, you know, if I'm looking at the values of the registers, they're all going to make sense. I'm not going to notice that I computed R11 before I computed R9. Like, I'm not going to be able to notice that, but we're going to compute R11 earlier because, you know, we have some time where otherwise we'd be doing nothing. And in this design, you'll note that I have kind of extra pipeline stages. We'll talk about those more explicitly in a bit. But we have some stuff that we do sort of for every instruction in order because, well, you know, we can fetch them in order and so on. And we also have some work we do at the end to like finish up the instructions. And this is going to be part of providing that illusion that everything's done in order. That we're going to handle anything that might complicate things with us realizing that, oh, R9 and R11 weren't written in the order I wrote. Sort of questions on the concept of this out-of-order execution. Yeah?
So, like, in the analogy of, like, a laundry cycle, like, say, is it the same as, like, if you've done with the washer? You kind of, is that waiting for the dryer, you just do something else with the washer?
Like, so the question is the analogy for the laundry, if we're done with the washer, instead of waiting for the dryer, we do something else? That might be one way of thinking about it. So this doesn't have, like, a precise analog, because usually where this happens is we have something busy, like the memory, that we're either, we have a bunch of things that don't care about it, you know. So like maybe the laundry scenario analogy would be, if we have a bunch of things that don't need the dryer, we can just do them, right, without worrying about the dryer, waiting for the dryer. This might be a better kind of analogy for the sort of thing that's going on. What are the extra letters? We'll talk about that very explicitly in a bit. But basically, we're going to need extra stages of bookkeeping and processing to implement this strategy, at least implement it efficiently. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about what we need to do to implement this out-of-order idea. And the main challenge with this is dealing with providing that illusion that the work's done in order and making sure we get the same answers as if it was done in order. And there are things where we have these forwarding strategies, but we can't really apply these forwarding strategies the way we used to. So let's look at one example of this. So with a normal pipeline, we said, oh, okay, in this case, you know, I'm going to need to get the value of R8 for this add R12 comma R8 instruction, and I have two places I could get it from. Well, I know I got it from the instruction that's kind of furthest along. This is not going to work. This heuristic is not going to work in our out-of-order processor. So here, if I just get it from the instruction that's furthest along, you know, in the pipeline, then, not furthest along, the instruction that's in the sort of earliest stage. So if I get it from the instruction that's in the earliest stage, that's the wrong version of R8. The most recent one is actually the one from the IR move queue, which finished a while ago. So that heuristic doesn't work. So somehow you have to figure out, in a case like this, that, oh, the R8 I want is actually this one from the IR move queue. I don't want the one from that add queue. And note that I need to figure that out, but I can't just say, oh, this add queue doesn't matter, because in this case, well, we actually need the value from the add queue to run this I should rename these instructions correctly for this class. These are just move queues, is how you should read them. Sorry, have prefixes from 30 through 30 that you don't do in this class. But I have this move into RAX that needs the value of R8 from the add. So we're like, we can't discard the result of the add, we still need it, but it's not the one we want for the later add. Some questions? Yes. So we need to do some sort of bookkeeping where we can figure out scenarios like this, which version of R8 we want. And a systematic way of doing this is to track the different versions of R8 explicitly. That we're going to have different versions of the value, and we'll just track which version we have at each point. And when we're checking how to forward R8, we're not going to say, let's look for R8 earlier in the pipeline. We're going to say, let's look for R8 version 3. We're going to look explicitly for a specific version. So a way I could implement this is that I'll have this pre-processing step where I'll take my instructions and I'll rewrite them to specify what versions of the registers they use. So rather than saying I have an add of R10 into R8, I'll say I'll have an add of R10 which takes R8 version 1 and produces R8 version 2. And when I'm checking how do I forward values, I'm going to say, okay, you know, if I'm going to look for what instruction produces R8 version 1, and if we're looking at the next instruction, it's going to look for R8 version 2 specifically. So it's going to know whether it can forward that because we're going to match these version numbers exactly. So questions about this idea of tracking different versions of a register? Okay. And so far, it looks like we're just tracking different version numbers to know that if we have multiple values that are all R8 in our pipeline, which one do we use? But in fact, we're going to need this for a more serious reason. Oh, I should. Again, I've cut this up here. So in this case, I have four different versions of R8 we're producing here. Right? So we have this add instruction that is producing one version that should make it to this first move instruction. I have this second move instruction that's producing another version, which should make it to this second move instruction. And then I have a third version, which should make it to this add instruction. And it's possible in an out-of-order processor that we'll end up executing these instructions such that we need all these versions of R8 stored in our registers or something because we're not actually executing the instruction that needs that value yet. So you can see here that when I'm at, say, pipeline stage 7, here, I need to actually have stored somewhere two different copies of R8 with different values somehow. So how do we deal with this problem if we're going to be executing instructions out of order like this, where we might have different versions of R8 we need at the same time? So a conclusion we can get from this is that we probably can't use our normal register file idea of just having one place to store the current value of R8. And that's, in fact, what we're going to do. We're going to deal with. We're going to have multiple copies of R8. So we're going to have lots of extra registers, so we can store not just R8, but we can store each different version of R8. So we'll have a separate register for each version. And that's how we'll deal with the problem of what if I produce two different versions and I need both of them. We'll have a separate place to store them in our register file in addition to forwarding them around. So to implement this idea, we're going to take our instructions that use R8 and we're going to do what's called register renaming. We're going to rewrite those instructions to actually use separate registers for each version. So to change the names of all the registers in the instruction to these real register names in our big register file. So rather than having a register file that has like 16 registers, we'll have a register file with like 80. And we'll just assign a different register for each different version of a value, of a what we'll call an architectural register, a register that appears in assembly. So that's this idea of register renaming, that we're going to rename our instructions from using the assembly registers to using this bigger set of physical registers. And we're going to make sure each different version of a register's value is going to have a different physical register. And this makes sort of all our bookkeeping a lot easier. So we want to figure out, do I have the value ready yet? I just need to say, do I have any value for this register? If the answer is no, I don't have it ready. If the answer is yes, I have it. I don't need to worry about is it the most up-to-date, because there's only one. Either it's set or it's not set. And for forwarding, I just need to say, do I have something that produced this register? If the answer is yes, I can forward it. If the answer is no, I can't. I don't need to worry about multiple versions because there's only one. We're only using each register, writing to each register once. Some questions about this idea of doing register renaming. Yes?
Wouldn't we run out of
question, wouldn't we run out of physical registers? Yes. So our solution for that is we're going to have some way of figuring out no one's using this register anymore and reclaiming it. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Would you say this is almost analogous to like virtual memory?
Question, is this analogous to virtual to physical mapping? Yeah, in a way. Other questions? Okay. So let me show you kind of an idea of what the sort of high-level design for a processor that uses this strategy can look like. So this is just a pipeline, and we've added extra stuff to handle this out-of-order execution. So I have my instruction cache here. So here's my fetch stage. And it's going to work kind of like the fetch stage we saw, except this time we want to do multiple issue and out of order, so we're going to be fetching several instructions at once. And we're also going to probably have more branch prediction stuff than we're used to. So one thing we're going to want to do to make this run efficiently, if we're fetching multiple instructions at once, is we want to actually, you know, figure out what instructions to fetch before we've actually had time to like completely to actually like go through the instructions. So we'll have branch prediction that needs to be really good to keep this pipeline full, especially since we have multiple stages before we get to the actual point where we figure out like if branches are taken and so on. And one thing we're going to want to do if we're fetching multiple instructions at a time is that if I have like a branch in the middle, I want to like predict that, you know, right away where it goes. And I also need to handle some cases that we haven't seen. Where we haven't seen and that where we haven't actually gotten the instruction yet. And this means that kind of our assumption that, you know, we're going to take one cycle and figure out everything in the instruction doesn't really work out. And there's a bunch of things that are going to often happen is that we want to actually fetch lots of instructions per cycle, and we're going to have a complicated machine code format and so on. So how do we do branch prediction efficiently, you know, if it's going to take us a while to actually figure out what's in the instructions, especially since we have so many? And a common thing these processors will do is, in addition to having the kind of historical information we've seen for, was this branch taken the last time or not, they'll just have a cache with information about what types of branches were there. So rather than actually looking at the machine code to figure out there's a conditional jump here, they'll have a cache that says there was a conditional jump there, so they don't need to check again. And this is commonly known as a branch target buffer. So not only will it say there's a conditional jump, but it will also say, oh, it went to this address, so we can make a branch prediction right away. And we'll even have that for unconditional jumps, right? Because we won't have enough time to actually figure out where they go and practice a lot of the time. Or it will help remind us that there's a return or a call. We'll just have that information stored in this cache, special cache here. Another thing related to this that comes up is that when we have computed jumps, so let's say we have a jump based on a register value, we want to predict those too. So one way we can do that is that we could say that there's going to be an entry for a computed jump here, and we'll just put the target in this cache of recent instructions that cause us to need to go fetch something else. Another thing we can do is, rather than looking up the instruction, we can look up the instruction and some context, you know, in a table and have a predictor for that. And this is commonly something we'll do in these out-of-order processors. So, because a big concern here is that in order to make these efficient, not only do we need to like predict branches, we need to do it when we don't have full information on the instructions yet. And our solution for that is to make much better use of the history of what happened recently. So that's on branch prediction. So we're going to have lots of branch prediction. We're going to have branch prediction that needs to act before we've actually figured out what's in the instructions. We're going to use some tables to make that possible. And predicting not only is the branch taken or not, but where does it go in the case of like computed jumps or calls or so on. before you've actually read the full instruction. So then we're going to have this stage where we do register renaming. So we're going to do that mapping from the architectural registers to the physical registers. And we're going to do what I've called dispatch, which is going to be putting the instructions that we've processed into this queue. So this is where we're going to have things run out of order. So far, this first part of the processor is doing everything in order. We're taking a bunch of instructions every cycle. We're fetching them. We're making a prediction about what where we should go next. We're fetching those. But we're doing it in what we think the order the program's going to run them is. But after this point, we're going to have this queue. And this whole part of the processor after that queue, this is going to be run out of order. Meaning that we're going to run things as they're available here, rather than doing it in the order they're quote unquote supposed to run. So this renaming step is going to process those instructions to use those physical register names. And then we're going to have this list of pending instructions. And we're also going to have a list of what register values are ready. And we're going to combine that to figure out which instructions should we start. And that term for start we'll use is issue. So which instructions should be issued to actually do their work. And when we issue them, we're going to handle reading their register values or forwarding them. And then we're going to send them to one or more what we'll call execution units. So the execution units are typically where we'll do the math for the instruction, but we'll also lump in, for example, loading or storing values. That will be an execution unit. We'll just send the instruction to do their actual work, quote unquote, which might be addition, it might be a load or a store, might be a comparison, but where the actual work for the instruction will happen. And we'll have a big array of these because we want to run multiple instructions at a time. And the idea is if we have four different instructions, hopefully we can find four different execution units to run them all on, assuming they're independent and all ready to go. And then, once that's done, we'll write back the results to our big register file. And that's the end of this out of order part. Now I have this last thing labeled commit. So once we're all done with the instruction and we're going to look at the instructions in order, and we're going to finalize the instruction. So this is where we're going to do things like figure out, oh, the register, this physical register this instruction used is no longer needed anymore. I can use it for other things. And this is generally, we're going to handle like just all the sort of work of cleaning up all the bookkeeping we've done for an instruction. And we have this data structure here called a reorder buffer. And this is going to be how we manage things like, what if I run instructions from a branch misprediction, how do I undo those? Or what if I have a seg fault and I ran instructions after the seg fault that shouldn't have run? The reorder buffer is how we're going to undo the reordering and make it appear that the program just stopped where it was supposed to stop and didn't run this extra stuff. So questions? This high level, yes.
Is this actually faster than running a typical pipeline?
So is this actually faster than running a pipeline? Yes, because typically we'll be able to sort of average more than one instruction per cycle. And depending on the program, often a lot more than one instruction per cycle. Also, even if we don't average more than one instruction per cycle, this lets us do work while a slow load or store is happening. So we can have one instruction stuck on that load or store, but we can run a whole bunch of other stuff while that's happening. Does that answer your question? Other questions? But I guess one of your concerns was this is a lot of extra work, a lot of extra bookkeeping. Yes, it is. So like this is not something we want to do like if we wanted to be low power, for example. And so we can kind of visualize what happens with a pipeline diagram like this. So we have a fetch stage, but we're going to fetch multiple instructions at once. So in this example, I'm doing two on a more current day sort of laptop or desktop processor would probably be around 4 or 5. And that fetching is going to include taking into account branch prediction, you know, which makes the branch prediction incredibly more complicated. And then we're going to have decode each instruction. In this case, decode means like actually process the machine code, do the register renaming. And then we're going to issue the instructions as their operands are ready. So for example, here, we couldn't issue this conditional jump until after the compare finished, because it needs the results of the comparison to do its work. We couldn't issue this second add here until the first add finished, because they depend on each other. So we're going to issue things as values are ready, but not earlier. And sometimes we'll issue instructions where we skip ahead. So you see this example here, where because I can issue this compare and this add because all my registers for that were ready, but I couldn't issue the actual work for the jump because I wasn't ready to figure out if the condition codes were met because the condition codes weren't computed yet. Okay, so questions as part of the pipeline. And we have this final stage labeled commit, and this is going to happen in order. So once the instructions are complete, we're going to go to the first, in order, we're going to do this finalization stage to clean up the instruction. Now that we know we've gotten to all the instructions up to there, so we can finish it entirely, that we have its value, and we can make sure that it's all set, and we've done all our garbage collection for anything it might be using. Yes? Question is, we fetch both the jump and the add at the same time? Yes.
Yeah, so does it need to do branch prediction while it fetches all of them at once? So is it, how does it know to predict the add queue if it's fetching it?
So the question is, how can we know to predict the add queue if we're fetching the jump at the same time? So that's why we're going to have this branch target buffer idea. So we can look up as we're fetching and realize there's a conditional jump there and realize we also need to fetch this add based on our prediction. Does that answer your question? Yeah, but this is why we need this kind of cache table, because we actually want to take into account a prediction in one cycle, ideally. Is that, question?
So are you expecting the jump, the address of where it's jumping, the actual jump where it's jumping to, and then the add queue right after, so are you fetching three events?
So question, are we fetching three? So this design, we're assuming we're only fetching two at a time, but I'm assuming that somehow I'm going to use my branch target buffer and realize, the instruction I want to fetch is this conditional jump, and the add queue we're going to predict it jumps to. Even though that is, very complicated in logic. I don't actually know the details of exactly what processors will fetch together, but it is important to do the branch prediction on typically four instructions at once, because they're fetching four. So they need to figure out, is this a conditional jump that I need to fetch something else for and all that? And that is a big part of the extra logic they need to add to implement this efficiently. Other questions? Okay. So then we finally have this commit to finalize the instruction and clean up any resources it was using. Okay, so let's look at this rename step. So in the rename step, we're going to rename our architectural registers, the ones from assembly, to physical ones. So we're going to have this one-to-one mapping. So we'll maintain a table of sort of the external names to the current next internal name for the next instruction we're going to process. And we'll also have a list of physical registers that currently aren't being used. How will this list get filled? Well, as instructions commit, we'll be able to free up registers. We'll know that they're not being used anymore, and we'll add them back to this list. And what we're going to do is we're going to go through each instruction. We're going to say, so I have my first add here. It uses R10. R10 is X19. It uses R8. R8 is currently X13, but we're going to make a new version of that. And to make a new version, that means I'm going to take one of my free registers and make that the new version of R8. So conceptually, we've said we have, this is sort of R8 version 0, and this is R8 version 1. So questions? What's that? And since our new R8 version 1 is the current version of R8, I've updated my map from architectural to physical register to include it. This means when I process my next instruction, I'm going to look for R11, that's X07, and I'm going to look for R8, which is currently X18, and I'm writing a new version of R8, so I'm going to take yet another register off my free list, and that's going to be my version 2 of R8. That's going to be what this register, this instruction writes to. Then we're going to take the next instruction, uses R12, which is X05, and uses the current R8, which is X20, and produces a new one, which I'm going to just take the next thing off my list, which is going to be X21. Some questions on how I did this process? Yeah?
So for R8, it's not using X20 anymore, it's really using X21. Is there any way for the processor to know that from that point now on, R8 won't use X20 anymore and it can't be available?
So the question is, how are we going to know when to free X20? So this is what that commit stage is going to have the logic to figure out. Note that we can't do it right now because we've just pre-processed these instructions, but we haven't run them yet. So when we can stop using X20 is only going to be sort of after we finish this instruction, which we know there's, because it overwrote X20, overwrote R8, we know X20 isn't being used anymore. So we're going to have something in the commit stage to realize, oh, this instruction overwrote R8, which was X20, therefore every instruction after it won't be using X20 now. So if every instruction up to this instruction has completed, I can get rid of I can put X20 on the free list. And that's the logic that's going to be in the commit stage. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do a different example here. So let's say I have, go through here, so I have add R10 to R8, so that starts the same way. We take R10 is X19, the old version of R8 was X13, we're gonna make a new one, so it's gonna go into X18. Then I have, I keep forgetting to get rid of the extra stuff off my moves. Then we have a move from R8 into RAX. So I'm gonna have to rename this. So what I'm gonna do, I'm going to move from the current version of R8, which is X18, and I'm also gonna have to read from RAX. Because even though RAX is in the destination part of the assembly, it's a value we're reading to figure out where to write to memory. So we're not gonna make a new version of it. We're going to make a new version of a memory location. So in this case, we're reading from X18 and X04. We don't need to update the version of RAX. It's going to stay X04 because we're not changing it. Then I have the subtract. I'm going to use the current version of R8, which is still X18. And I'm going to read from R11, which was X07. That's the old version, and I'm going to make a new version, which is X20. So questions about what I did so far? Yeah?
So for R11, it seems like we lose version 1, X7. So will that be registered as registered?
It seems like we use version 1. Will that be registered as a what register?
So, for register R11,
yeah.
We updated the value of that register, so the now physical name is X20. Because, would X7 be placed under 3?
Question, now that we were using X20 to store R11, would X07 be placed under 3? It won't be placed now because we haven't actually run these instructions yet. We've just pre-processed them so we can run them later. But later on, when we run all the instructions up to this subtract, then we'll be able to free x07. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
What was that thing you mentioned about the memory address?
What was the thing about memory? So I was going to get to that next. So if we look at the next instruction, this instruction here is reading from, so I guess there's one thing I did mention. So note that this instruction here, we used RAX here. This is a memory address. So that's why we're reading from X04. We're not writing to it. We don't need a new version. And we don't have to worry about modifying RAX, but we do have to worry about modifying this memory location, because later on, it might be the case that we might be unlucky, and it might be the case that this instruction writes to the same place that this future instruction reads from. And we want it to realize that, oh, if that's true, we better run them in order. We can't run them out of order. But we don't have registers to look at for that. So you might say, how does the processor keep us running these in the right order? Like, I know for registers, we have this information about, you know, which version is which, so we know we have the right version. How do we do that for arbitrary locations in memory? You know, just in case RAX and 8 plus R11 are the same value. And this is something the processor needs to worry about. And there's basically two strategies. And the first one is we can run the loads and stores in order. That works, but it's slow. So what most processors do is that we're going to, at some point, compare the load and store addresses and figure out if there was a problem. And often, this will be done with kind of a branch prediction idea that will guess that the load and store addresses aren't equal. And if they turn out to be equal, we'll undo some instructions to fix it. So that's how we'll deal with that. I'm not going to go through how we make that logic, because that's obviously really complicated. But it is, in fact, something processors do, because, you know, it really matters if we can run these loads and stores out of order. It really helps, especially if, like, one of them would hit the cache and one of them would miss. Right? We really want to be able to run the ones that hit the cache while we're waiting for a slow cache miss. Okay. So then we have our move queue instruction here. So here I'm going to read from R11 to compute my address. And I'm just noting a read from memory, because we're going to have to deal with what if those are two the same memory location. And then we write to a new version of R11, which we're going to call X21. And then I have this move here. I'll also cross out the extra junk on my moves. That moves a constant into R8. In this case, I'm just going to make a new version of R8. I don't write down the old one, because we don't care. Like, we can run this move instruction without the old version of R8, so we're going to do that. That's why in this preprocessing step, I'm noting that for later, so we don't wait until, you know, this for add runs to run this move. We don't need to do that. And then I have this final add, which is going to use our new version of R8 to produce yet another one. And also R11, which is, you know, some questions on my register renaming. Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. Let's do our rename these first few instructions, which is also part of the out of order homework. Someone tell me, let's start, so our first line here, add. So again, it's going to be start, yeah.
It's add X13 to R17 for the X18.
X17 becomes X18, yeah. So what we did here is you said, okay, R8, that's 13, or 9 is 17, so that's where we're going to have the old version. And the new version, we're going to take the first free register here, and we're going to update our mapping to use X18. So questions? process. Okay, how about the next one? Anyone? Yeah. So you want to do move, and you say x19 to x20. You probably want the 100 in there too somewhere. Yeah. So I like this idea, because we're following the same pattern, but we have to pay careful attention. Does this move instruction care about what R10 was? It does not. So we're going to use x20, and we're going to update what R10 is, but we don't care about what it was before, because we're not going to bother reading the old version of R10 for this. And here, this is really important not to do, because if we write down that it needs the old version of R10, then we're going to wait until whatever prior instruction computed R10 before we run this move, which we don't need to do. Is that clear? Questions? And that subtlety is exactly why it's in this exercise, because a lot of people miss that if we don't read a register, we shouldn't write it down, because we don't want later on us to delay writing this instruction unnecessarily. Okay, how about our next step, the subtract? Anyone? So I have, here we have a subtract, and we want to look at the current version of R10, which we just updated to X20. If that better be the same thing, the move row, we don't want a different R10. So we're going to take X20, and we also need to read R8, which is X13, and we're going to write something, which is going to be a new version of R8. So I'm going to take X21 off of here, and that's going to be our new R8. Yes?
For the queue, why do you have to update R10 if you're not going to care about what it is before?
Question, why do we have to update R10 if we're not going to care about what it is before? So we wanted it to be the case that we figured out how to translate the subtract. I looked for x20, the value the move produced.
But why can't we just look for R19?
So the question is, why can't this move write to R19? Because there might be an instruction above here that uses, so let's say I had an add R10, R11, that add would have been translated to use X19. And we don't want it to be the case that we'll write X19 twice and have two different values, right? The whole point of registry naming is there's only one value in a register ever. Does that answer your question? So whenever we're writing somewhere, we always make a nice, fresh register so we only have one value stored until we do that whole garbage collection step at the end. Other questions? Okay, so I'll go through our XOR here. So we read from R8, which is currently X21, and R9, which is currently X18, and we make a write to a new register, which is going to be X23, which is going to be our new version of R9. And then I have this AND, where we're going to read from RAX, which is X04, and the current R9, which we just made X23, and we're going to write to the new X24. That's going to be our final version of R9. Questions? This process. Okay, so this is the registry naming step, and what that's going to let us do is once we've done a bunch of registry naming, we're going to have all our instructions marked as to what registers they use as inputs and outputs. And in this case, I've also made sure that I marked our compare as writing its condition code somewhere, and our jump as reading condition codes from somewhere, so I know when I can run it. And after we've done all this pre-processing, we're going to be able to just keep track of what sometimes it's called a scoreboard, of which registers have their values ready, and I'm going to figure out how to assign them to execution units. So during the first cycle, I'm going to look at, you know, I want to put something on these two ALUs, these two things that can do arithmetic, arithmetic logic units. So I'm going to say, let's look at the first instruction. It needs 1 and 5. Those are both ready. So I'm going to put it on ALU1. Then I'm going to look at the second instruction. 2 is ready, but 6 isn't, so I can't put it on ALU2. I'm going to look at the third instruction. 3 is ready, 7 is not. So I can't put it on ALU2. I'm going to look at the fourth instruction. 4 is ready, 8 is not, so I can't run it. I'm going to look at the fifth instruction. 9, not ready, can't run it. I'm going to look at the sixth instruction. 1 is ready, 8 is not, can't run it. I'm just going to keep going, and I'll find out in this case that even though I have two things that can run instructions, I only have one instruction that's actually ready to run. Just a shame. But, so we'll just assign instruction 1, and it's going to run. And then after it finishes, let's say it takes 1 cycle, we're going to mark register 6 is ready, because now its value is going to be available for future instructions. And I'm going to do the same process. So I'm going to look through. I'm going to say, oh, this instruction 2, you know, so we've done instruction 1. Instruction 2, is register 2 ready? Yes. Is register 6 ready? Yes. I can put instruction 2 on the ALU in the next cycle. I'm going to go through all the other instructions, and I'm going to find out the same disappointing result that, yes, I found one thing to run, but only one thing. Too bad. But after instruction 2 finishes, I'll be able to mark register 7 is ready. So during the next cycle, I'm going to do this process again. I'm going to look for things that need register 7, and I'm going to find out that the only one that matches is instruction 3. But now, finally, something different than our pipeline processor happens. So with instruction 3 finished, I'm going to look through my instructions and say, okay, instruction 4, it needs register 4, that is ready. It needs register 8, that is ready. We can run this, so we're going to run instruction 4. Instruction 5 needs register 9, that's not ready. Instruction 6 needs register 1, that is ready. It needs register 8, that's ready. We can also run instruction 6, so we're going to run 4 and 6 at the same time, because we have two things that can run them. So that's going to be what we'll run the next cycle. And when those finish, we're going to mark those two registers they write to, so register 9 and register 10 as ready. And then in the following cycle, we're going to do the same analysis and find out, oh, now that means I can run instruction 5 and instruction 7. So we're going to run both of those in the next cycle. And then I'm going to get back to my unfortunate situation. We're going to scan through all my instructions and find out, well, turns out there's only one that can run right now, and that's going to be the X11 one. This is ready, that one. And so we'll end up with this kind of pipeline, this kind of execution. Questions on sort of my simulation of what the instruction queue did. Yeah?
How do you know like how far to go down in the instruction queue?
Question, how do I know how far to go down in the instruction queue? Conceptually, we're going to check every instruction every time until we run out of places to put them.
Okay.
So obviously, implementing that in hardware might be challenging if our instruction queue is really big. And that probably means the instruction queue can only be so big. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? So something worth mentioning about that we can do in registry naming is that so far it may look like, you know, we just, you know, look at our instruction and look at the registers it uses and just translate it to a version with just different register numbers. But we can do a little more, and most processors actually do. So one example is, let's say I have a pop instruction. The pop instruction uses RSP. So in order for this register renaming idea to work, to know when the pop instruction can run and have the right inputs, we need to write down what physical register that RSP is stored in. Also, the pop instruction is kind of complicated. It does a whole bunch of things. So a common strategy for dealing with these problems is that we'll take some complicated instruction like this pop and rewrite it to more instructions, more simpler instructions during this register renaming phase. We're already processing all the instructions to change them. It's relatively easy to do some more complicated changes than just adjusting the register numbers. And this is, in fact, something most out-of-order processors do at least a little bit of. We can also do things like make sure we sort of explicitly track, say, condition codes, rather than having that be implicit. And this is one way of dealing with the problem of, like, how do we make sure, you know, we're using the right version of the condition codes. If we're running the compares out of order, we can track them like registers and use the same mechanism. That's one option for dealing with that. Okay, so questions? Okay, so one other thing to mention with sort of this dispatch process is often, rather than having sort of multiple places to put instructions that work for all instructions, often we'll have kind of specialized places that will have, say, an ALU where you can send instructions to or a data cache. And these moves from memory, they can use the data cache, the other instructions need the ALU, the arithmetic. And so what we'll do in this case is we'll say, okay, during cycle one, I'm going to want to try to put something on the ALU. Well, I can't put these moves from the data cache on the ALU, so I'm just going to skip those. I'm going to check, is one available? Is two available? Yes. So I'm going to run instruction three there. Then I'll try to say, what can I put in the data cache? Say, well, instruction one, it needs X4. Is that available? Yes. So we're going to run instruction one. And then I'll go to my next cycle, and let's say these both finish in one cycle. So in that case, I have the 6 is ready from our instruction 1, and 8 is ready from our instruction 3. And I'll look again. So now I've done 1 and 3, so I'm going to look for, what can I do in the ALU? I'm going to skip over my instruction that uses the data cache, and I'm going to say, is 1 available? Yes. Is 6 available? Yes. I can do instruction 4. And then I'm going to look for, what can I do in my data cache? I have one candidate here. Is 5 available? Yes. I'm going to do that. And I'll keep going, marking the registers that get written as ready as we go through. But so often we'll have these kind of specialized slots for instructions, and this sort of makes things more efficient, because now I don't need to have like 4 different inputs to my data cache. I can still have one. And I don't need to have like 4 different multipliers. I can just have one if we don't think we're running multiplies all the time. And I can kind of, do more with the stuff I would already have in my sort of normal pipeline processor anyways. I still have a data cache and a multiplier, for example. So questions? This dispatch. Okay. So let's talk a little more about what these execution units like look like. So these execution units, I've kind of shown them as they just do the work in one cycle, but often they're actually pipelines. So often, especially for things like multiplies or other complicated operations, it will take multiple stages, and we might have, for example, a multiplier that takes 3 cycles to multiply, but it's pipeline, so it accepts a new thing to multiply every cycle. So question here, how long does this take to compute this expression? Yes, I'm out of time. So, talk about the answer is we're going to have to compute C times D, which is going to take 3 cycles. Then we're going to compute that times B, which is going to take another 3 cycles. And then we're going to compute that times A, which is going to take another 3 cycles. So it's going to take 9. But you might say, wait a moment, it's pipeline. Doesn't that mean we should be able to do one every cycle? Well, yes, but not if they depend on each other. So if I was instead asking, how long would it take to compute A times B and C times D and D times E? Well, in that case, we do A times B, and well, after it started, we do C times D. And after that started, we do D times E, and we'd end up taking a total of 5 cycles. But because these depend on each other, you know, the best we can do, and what our out-of-order processor is going to end up doing, is executing them one after the other, because we don't have any better choice. Okay, so that's where we're going to finish up today. And we'll pick up on this and more at efficiency of out-of-order processors. Thank you.